You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
I received a piece of work from the 91 London Investment Institute, which was co-authored by Philip Saunders and Sahil Mattani, and it starts like this. It says, with the US performing strongly and China showing signs of turning a corner, a global economic recovery is building. There are abundant opportunities for investors, but 2025 requires a new investment playbook, it says. Philip Saunders and Sahil Mattani, as I said, were the co-authors. But with me today is Philip Saunders from 91 in London. And you mentioned at the end of it, you talk about where the pitfalls lie, Philip. And I think before we get into the nitty-gritty of this piece, I think the first pitfall is making predictions, because if you get the predictions right, people will say, well, you're supposed to because you're an investment professional. If you get them wrong, there the pitfalls lie. But how difficult or easy was it for you to look forward to 2025?
Look, Lindsay, it's always difficult. And nobody's got a perfect crystal ball. I think it's particularly difficult to forecast a year ahead. We're also in an environment, which is still this sort of post-COVID environment, or post-GFC environment also, where unusual things happen. So, for example, when the Fed cut rates back in September, bonds sold off. And that's highly unusual. So I think that it's particularly difficult at the moment. But I think that that doesn't mean that it's not worth even attempting to sort of go through the process, because I think it's a good discipline.
Let's start with your first point. I don't want to be too prescriptive about this and go number one, number two, etc. We'll let the conversation flow. But let's go to macro first of all. There are three regions that I always look at when I first get up in the morning, and that's the United States, China, and Europe. Now, the US is doing okay. I mean, it created, I think, the last jobs print, the non-farm payrolls number was something like 256,000 jobs were created, which is pretty good. And it's still a robust situation over there. China, I noticed, is forecast to grow 4.7% this year, even with the prospect of Trump tariffs. Europe, on the other hand, slightly different. But maybe you could summarize those three regions for us.
Sure. So, the US is obviously the locomotive economy at the moment. It managed to avoid a recession, which obviously caught a lot of people off guard, because the odds were pretty high that that would happen, or at least a period of much weaker growth. That's substantially down to obviously what's been happening in terms of AI investment. On the one hand, it's consumers, having pretty good balance sheets at the moment, supported by COVID handouts, and obviously the massive government deficit run in order to finance those handouts, and a whole bunch of projects that Biden got through Congress and the Senate during his term. So the US has been running, unusually for a period when the economy has positive traction, 7% a deficit, which is equivalent to 7% of annual GDP, which is normally something you see as part of a strategy to bolster growth in a particularly weak economic environment. So pretty unusual. But the US basically economy has momentum. It's pretty healthy because, despite the fact the government basically has borrowed a lot, households are in good shape. We're seeing real wages basically drive growth because manufacturing has continued to be pretty weak, but services have more than offset that. And I think looking forward over the next 12 months or so, in the US, we think we see more of the same. We see positive productivity contribution, which is very unlike the last sort of decade or so, when productivity is run at about 1%. It's running, at least double that at the moment. And that means you can have pretty strong growth, i.e. above trend growth, without the sort of typical inflationary consequences that people, obviously worrying about at the moment. So that's the US, and we think that that is generally quite constructive for global growth. Let's flip to Europe, and Europe looks pretty miserable, but that's the dominant narrative at any rate. So much of that is presumably in the price.
Sorry to interrupt. Is that because of mainly because of the demise of the German economy and the German political situation? Because it looks pretty dire in Germany. Is that the main driver of Europe's sluggishness?
I think that's Germany and France in particular struggling, and you know, part of that relates to, you know, the fact that China is becoming Germany's competitor. It used to be its customer, it's now its competitor, and obviously that's most visible in the area of electric vehicles, where China is very dominant. But it's also in areas like machine tools, i.e., traditionally areas that German industry dominated. And also high energy input costs, you know, because the sort of, you know, German miracle, or the recent version of it, was, you know, basically Chinese demand and very low energy costs as a result of Russian gas. So now Europe has very high energy costs, and that, of course, makes it less competitive. And that, I think, is a big structural challenge for the likes of Germany. However, if we look more broadly in Europe, I think if you look at the likes of Spain and East Europe, I mean, like Poland has been phenomenally successful. So we need to be a bit careful, because there are some economies in Europe actually doing pretty well at the moment.
Okay, so it's a fragmented Eurozone, if you like.
And sure.
Now, China, I threw out a figure of 4.7%, which is something I read on a website, and one doesn't know where that comes from. But
we don't really believe it.
Oh, you don't believe it?
So these are sort of, and funnily enough, they always achieve their targets, and so one shouldn't put too much store in that. So clearly, growth this year has been significantly weaker in reality than the official numbers, because the consumer in China has remained pretty weak. And China basically has relied very heavily on exports to keep the show on the road. I think looking forward into next year, or the current year as it is now, you know, we have a rather contrarian view, in the sense that most, you know, the narrative is that China basically is beset with problems with its property market and with excessive amounts of debt. And sure, you know, China, like just about every other economic bloc, faces challenges. But we think that the powers that be now are sufficiently alarmed that we've seen, you know, significant moves to try and bolster growth over the course of 2024. Those often will have a lagged impact. And in the year ahead, you know, we expect, you know, QE with Chinese characteristics as being an anti-deflationary sort of kind of step. And interest rates are being kept very, very low. So I think that we think that the bias is for China to do a bit better than expected is strong. And if it does, and if we're right about Trump, Trump's not interested in an all-out trade war with China, as far as we can see, then I think that basically, you know, the Chinese economy might actually surprise on the upside.
Very good. So you don't believe the number that I gave, but you're leaning towards an upside surprise, which is very good. What about interest rates and bonds? Now, this has been an alarming trend in the just over 2 weeks of 2025. The bond market has had a horrible time, notably in the United Kingdom for internal reasons, but also in the United States and elsewhere, Philip.
Yes, it's apart from China, where bond yields continue to fall. Elsewhere, we've basically seen, you know, since the Fed, as I mentioned earlier, since the Fed reduced rates by 50 basis points, you know, actually bonds have had a torrid time. But we need to just step back from this and understand the context. And the context is a bond bear market. We're in a bond bear market, which has been underway since 2020. We happen to think we're in a different inflation and interest rate regime, which has sort of longer term consequences. But this particular move probably is pretty close to culmination. So we're getting to yields at which pretty attractive for longer term investors. We're very, actually pretty constructive about inflation for this year at any rate. Whereas, you know, inevitably there are going to be panics about, oh, growth is too strong and therefore there are inflationary consequences and Trump's going to put lots of tariffs in and they are automatically inflationary. Well, you know, that's not entirely the case. So the principal dynamic behind inflation, we believe, on a cyclical basis at any rate, is for decline. So we think that bond yields are there or thereabouts where they should be. And we've seen this sort of general repricing of capital going on over the last sort of, well, since 2020. Now, that, we believe, is actually quite a constructive thing because it means that the cost of borrowing is obviously going to remain significantly higher than it was in the post-GFC period. But, you know, that was abnormal, and that led to extraordinary levels of capital misallocation. So this time around, you know, as Rachel Reeves is discovering in the UK, you know, actually playing fast and loose, you know, means that your creditors basically revolt. And that imposes a discipline on governments, and it also imposes a discipline on corporates. So the kind of rampant financialization that characterized the post-GFC period, is ebbing. And I think that, you know, higher bond yields are part of that process. One final point, and that is that if the U.S. economy is going to continue to grow, as we believe it will, at a reasonable clip, then the Fed's not going to be able to cut short-term rates much, you know, if at all. And that then means that the yield curve has to normalize and investors need a term premium for, you know, lending long. And so therefore weakness at the long end, you know, is understandable in those circumstances. So this is not about a financial crisis. This is basically about sort of a logical response to economic conditions.
I was going to ask you about the Trump tariff situation, because everyone's jumped on the Trump tariff bandwagon and said that if he raises tariffs across the board, whether it be Mexico, Canada or China or the European Union, it doesn't matter. It's going to be inflation. But I don't want to do that because it's all up in the air. It's purely hypothetical. So we won't do that. Have a look at a couple of niched points that you make in your report, and that's credit. And you said that finding value will be key. And then you talk about emerging markets, fixed income. And when I see the strength of the US dollar, I think of the currencies in emerging markets. And that's never good for that particular market you've just mentioned. Maybe summarize those two asset classes, if you would.
Sure. So as far as credit is concerned, obviously credit spreads are incredibly narrow at the moment. And so that means that as an investor, you don't get a lot of compensation for the additional risk you're taking by going down the credit curve, so to speak. That is because actually the U.S. economy in particular didn't go into a recession. And there's a lot of capital around that's looking for a home, which has driven credit spreads to very low levels. But all good things come to an end. And, you know, what we're saying is that that we've in credit, we've got to keep credit duration pretty short now. It's not the time to basically extend, we believe. And one's got to look for sort of the niches that haven't fully repriced. And so we mentioned collateral loan obligations as one area that we think is attractively priced. However, having said that, you know, obviously interest rates are now at a different level. And that means that you can earn attractive real rates of return. So we've said it's sort of likely to be a coupon clipping year. So you're likely to sort of, if you're a credit investor, you're likely to enjoy your spread, i.e. get a higher yield, and you will not be punished for the sort of, you know, the lack of value, so to speak. That might be something for the future. Turning to emerging market fixed income, yes, I mean, the dollar has been sort of incredibly strong, and that's it tightens international credit conditions, and it's not particularly helpful. But the dollar is the dollar really going to have another major leg on the upside? I'm really not so sure. The U.S. is running an enormous current account deficit. And you know, other areas of the market, other areas of the world economy, you know, if they do somewhat better than currently discounted, then that's actually going to be quite helpful in terms of, you know, helping to stabilize currencies. So EM relative to the dollar is cheap. Inflation dynamics are really good. Inflation is generally continuing to come down, and short-term interest rates are going to come down on the back of that, whatever the dollar does.
Let's continue the EM theme, but moving to the asset class of equities. We'll start with developed markets, though. What a great year they had last year. If you look at the S&P, I can't remember the number, it was something like 23.5% increase, which is a fantastic performance. But not all developed markets equities are created equal, are they? I mean, you could say, you can look at Nvidia and you can look at Boeing and you say, wait a second, they're both in the same country, they're both doing different things, obviously, but there's been a huge divergence in performances.
Mm. Yes. So you've seen, you know, US equity performance has been very, very, you know, again, very concentrated, you know, like last year. And so, you know, the sort of big, you know, the Magnificent Seven in particular basically have their returns have dominated again, and returns elsewhere have been sort of okay, but relatively speaking, they look pretty pedestrian. And this, you know, is, you know, market concentration, you know, is the result of, you know, sort of momentum dominated environment you know, active managers have been sort of, you know, very concerned to sort of move away from benchmarks because it's more than their career is worth, so to speak. And so you have this effect, but it is anomalous and it's gone, we think, too far. And it will unravel at some point, you know, one doesn't know exactly when. So it's been U.S., you know, generating returns that have been way above other markets, particularly with the sort of help by the stronger dollar as well. And it's been a sort of particular section of the US market that has done sort of particularly well. And at some point, these things tend to, it's flowing, it will ebb at some point. And I think the context for that will be a better, broader cyclical recovery in the US and also around the world. And that's exactly what we envisage unfolding over the course of the year. It may well be the sort of second half of the year, but by and large, that is likely to be the key macro theme of the year. And equity markets are likely to respond, i.e. international markets tend to do better than the US. And the least favoured cyclical sectors in the US tend to actually have a period of recovery.
Just emerging markets now, quickly. I mean, I'm familiar with South Africa, and although it's a shrinking stock exchange in Johannesburg, there are some bargains to be had, and those bargains were being snapped up last year. So that's one thing. But do you highlight Asian tech? Give us an overview of the whole EM equities scene, if you would.
Yeah, so it's obviously not so much tech as far as South Africa is concerned, if you put sort of obviously process to one side. Mm. You know, I think as long as there's reform momentum in South Africa, as long as that holds up, and as long as inflation moderates, then that remains. And as long as you know, South Africa can attract international capital, you know, we're in a sort of bit of a virtuous circle, although there's some big structural challenges that haven't really been addressed as yet. Looking more widely, you know, actually, emerging markets more generally have changed in the sense that, you know, tech having been sort of a very modest sector has now become quite an important one. And the value in tech is probably in EM tech, and particularly in China, where you have obviously other challenges as an investor. So, you know, this is where you can, if you believe the future is in tech, then, you know, maybe you should be sort of cashing in some of your Nvidia exposure and diversifying it, and looking at opportunities outside the US.
Commodities now, a huge asset class for many emerging market economies. And I think the simple view is, from a simpleton, and I class myself as a simpleton, is that if economic growth is going to be coordinated with China and the United States at the forefront of global economic growth, then demand for commodities goes up. Do you see it that simply?
I see it. Sometimes things are pretty simple, and I see it that simply. So it's interesting that, you know, we've been in a period where, particularly with the weakness of China, because obviously China is obviously the sort of taker of 50% of a lot of commodities. You know, China has been weak, particularly traditional China, but commodity prices have actually held up pretty well in the circumstances. It's been a period of consolidation. And that is a testament to the fact that the industry, you know, over the years has consolidated, and it means that, you know, capital discipline has been pretty good amongst resource companies, and supply is relatively tight. So if we see a meaningful uptick in global demand, then we believe that resource stocks are going to benefit from that, and countries that basically are resource rich should benefit from that. All things being equal, obviously all things aren't necessarily equal. So pretty constructive about industrial metals on a sort of 1 year and beyond view. We're still constructive about gold. You know, because its sort of hedging attributes, I think, basically are now more widely appreciated. It's become a major reserve asset again for central banks. And oil, you know, oil, interestingly, is one of the ones where actually there's, you know, the potential for more supply than demand. And so therefore we're less constructive about oil prices. But, they've been strong in the early part of this year. And so we're unlikely to see oil prices weaken significantly from here.
Currencies, finally, terribly, terribly important for every single country in the world. The rate of their currency against the US dollar or whatever other currency they favour. But I was always taught when I first became, first sat on a trading broking desk, they said a currency move doesn't stop. It's a long-term move. And it seems to me that the long-term move at the moment is a strong US dollar. Do you see it that way in 2025, Philip?
So the dollar, you know, has remained in a bull market now for some years. And if you step back, you can see these sort of, you know, significant bull and bear markets, you know, that the dollar and other currencies have experienced. I mean, you know, currencies are like any other traded financial asset from that perspective. You know, people tend to focus on the short-term volatility, but if you step back, you can see that they have very pronounced trends. So the dollar remains in a bull market. From a valuation perspective, it's, you know, about as strong as it's been since the, you know, the Reagan dollar bull markets back in the 1980s. It means that the oxygen, you know, even if Trump turns out to be marvelous, you know, is really getting a bit thin for the currency. I think that, you know, we've got further, obviously, sort of in the first half of the year, we're likely to see sort of continued US exceptionalism in terms of its relative growth rate. And that tends to be currency supportive. And it'll be interesting to see how the dollar behaves in those circumstances. But we're sort of closer to the end than the beginning is the point I'm making. And ultimately, you know, valuation does have an effect, and so therefore, you know, ultimately the dollar will fall back from these kind of levels, or possibly slightly higher levels.
Finally, you talk about superpower rivalry, and I see them huffing and puffing, and there's some bristling, and there's some posturing. But do you worry about that sort of thing, or do you just say, look, it's just something for a major US TV network to headline, and we don't worry about that too much as an investment theme?
So geopolitics, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So. I think the reality of the situation is that we are in a Cold War, and, you know, it's sort of Cold War II. It's very different to Cold War I. And, you know, China's relationship with Russia, so-called dragon bear relationship, you know, is not going to change. And the there is going to be a parting of ways in many senses from a sort of more macroeconomic perspective. So that's a reality we have to live with and think about. However, you know, you've got an administration coming in that is pretty pragmatic. Got people like Elon Musk on board, who's got a significant business in China. You know, the Chinese and American economies, you know, many levels are going to remain highly integrated. And, you know, that actually probably suits everybody. However, America is going to be more forceful about protecting what it sees as its strategic interests, which China does already. So that, you know, that is probably makes sense. So, and I think that there will be proxy wars and conflicts and so forth, because, you know, this is not about kissing and making up. This is about striking a deal, establishing some kind of detente, but continuing to actually continue to face off against each other. So the Chinese are not going to suddenly stop building, expanding their navy, for example, and adding to their sort of their missile inventory. And this, of course, obviously is going to be pretty positive for capital investment, you know, because competition, you know, means that supply chains have to be moved. It means that there has to be investment in better defense products. And there is this general economic rivalry, because China and the US understand that ultimately it's about economic power. You know, Russia doesn't seem to understand that, but China certainly does.
Philip, thank you so much for your extended analysis. Philip Saunders is from the Investment Institute at 91 in London. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.